Yes. Okay. It's a question about practice. So for stage 5 and stage 6, you start to meditate and you're not sure about the presence of the subtle dramas. So I think you can start your practice with stage 5, and when it comes to the body scan, switch to stage 6. Do you think it's a good option? I think for me it's something more realistic and feasible if you have doubt about the subtle dramas presence.
The question is, if I understand correctly, is how do you know when you've dealt with subtle dullness sufficiently to proceed with stage 6? Okay. So, if there is no indication of at all of deepening subtle dullness, and if in fact your sense is that in this moment the quality of your mindfulness is better than it was when you first sat down, and it's been that way for a little while, then that's appropriate to do stage 6 practice.
Okay, but if you're still unsure, for instance, because I still have a lot of doubts regarding the subtle dullness. Even if you compare, you use your memory. So what I do is I start the practice at the stage 5, and when it comes to body scanning, I go to stage, I do a practice at stage 6. Do you think this is something?
What I suggest you do is you sit down and you brighten up the clarity of your perception and your peripheral awareness. And when it feels like it's pretty stable and compared to your past experience, it's pretty bright. And go ahead and begin to do stage 6 practices. Now, essentially, what you're going to be doing is just trying to keep your attention so stable on the meditation object that the attention stops alternating with subtle distractions in the background. So the subtle distractions, they don't go away, but they stop being subtle distractions. They're just things in peripheral or other things in peripheral awareness. Now, as long as you can do that and there's no problem, then you're doing just the right practice. If you've been doing body scanning, then now if you've reached the point where you've scanned the whole body, the sensations, breath-related sensations, or most of the body, or even if it's not, nevertheless, you start doing a whole body practice. No problem. If at any point, though, you feel like you're losing peripheral awareness, if you feel like there is some dullness coming in, then you just brighten up your attention and awareness. So you could actually be kind of alternating back and forth between 5 and 6, and that's absolutely fine. It's no problem. Anytime, it's really the same rule throughout stage 1. That, if you notice that something's happening that is a problem to be overcome in an earlier stage, if you notice that that's present, then you work on that. So you might be doing stage 6, and you might find that instead of the subtle distractions fading, you now got a gross distraction. Oh, okay. You know what to do. Yeah. Thank you.
In the book on the chapter, particularly regarding stage 6, when you say to ignore non-breath-related body sensations, does that include, when you're doing like a body scan kind of thing, does that include the sort of feeling of prana flow, or are you talking about sensations like itches?
I'm including to the degree that the prana is a breath-related sensation. You see, at first you're noticing sensations particularly that move in the same rhythm of the breath. But then, as you start to perceive these more clearly, you'll realize that that those were just the most obvious ones, and that there's a lot of other tonic sensations that are not necessarily that closely tied, but they're all part of the same kind of thing. So it's not as though you have to somehow say, well, okay, I'm going to only focus on those. You know, it's just the idea of making the object, the breath-related sensations, is to help you clearly define what it is that is going to be the object of attention so that you can make every effort to exclude anything other than what you've chosen. But don't make it unnecessarily difficult by trying to make a distinction that it is going to interfere with your ability to practice. So if you find some of it's hard to make a clear distinction between other tonic sensations and those that have the same more or less in-out flow with the breath, then just choose the set that is comfortable, that you can establish sort of your own boundary, that this is what I'm going to include and that's what I'm going to exclude, because that is the real point.
Now, what if, though, you're experiencing that thing where, like the movement around the nose doesn't seem to correlate with a breath, like it seems like the illusion is uncoupling a little bit, so...
Yeah, that's quite all right. As a matter of fact, you'll notice most of the time that the sensations that you feel from here to here are going in and out of sync with the sensations you feel in the periphery. And that's completely normal. But so that's what I mean. Don't try to make a distinction at that level. But in other words, you just decide for yourself that, okay, I'm going to include all these sensations. I'm not going to include the feeling of air moving on my skin from the fan, or, you know, things like that.
If you have a, if you get that sense of energy, more full energy blooming, like maybe rising or something, when you're trying to do stage five, should you purposefully turn away from that to the individual parts of the body still, or if that's not your intention to have that full bloom of energy?
Well. With regard to those peaky sensations, as long as you can just let them be in the background, and at stage five, it doesn't matter whether they're subtle distractions or just in peripheral awareness. But as long as they're not so strong that they're keeping you from falling the breath, then leave them in the background. But if at any point, they're just... They're so strong. Well, there's a combination. It could be the intensity of the sensation, or it could be your own mind's fascination with the sensation. But when you realize that between the combination of those two, you're not being successful in just letting them be while you focus your attention on the breath, then you might want to take them as an object. And often when they become that intense, just focusing your attention on and working with them will make them easier to more comfortable to be with. Not always. But that's just the general rule, is anytime something is sufficiently strong, sufficiently intrusive, that you can't maintain a focus on your chosen object, then switch and make that the object. But until that point, just let it happen in the background. If you, I just a question back to you. The sensations that you're talking about, are you feeling them mostly in your limbs or mostly in the central core of your body?
It starts off in the central core, then the whole body.
What's that?
It starts off in the central core.
But then you feel it in
the whole body, yeah. So it almost feels like, and then feeling the breath in the whole body up rather than doing the body scan.
Okay. That's good. It's good that you're feeling it in the rest of your body at the same time. So so just let it develop. It's a good time in progress.
It's not an issue I'm having in this retreat, but I just thought I'd ask.
Okay. Well, the next time it starts to happen, I'll have to answer. That's good. Jason.
I find that there are many superfluous actions that I'm taking that are associated with intending to move my attention, more vigorously attend to a thing, like tensing my face, or even just like my eyes looking in the direction of my nose, or something like that, regulating my pattern of breathing a little bit on a semi-conscious level. How important is it to root those out at this stage?
How important is it to...
Is it to, like, eliminate that at this stage? It feels like it would be a lot more pleasant to. Those are definitely associated with a sense of having to exert effort. I'm just curious. I've been playing around a lot with trying to decouple my concept of intending from all of those different actions.
Definitely, if you're noticing that there's a tendency for your breath to be altered in order to make it easier for you to perceive the sensations of it, definitely decouple any conscious intention from that.
Yeah.
But don't try to stop it from happening. Just you're not intentionally making it happen. And overcome the tendency to, in your own mind, take responsibility for making that happen when it wasn't the conscious you that did that. Things like eye movements, if I heard you correctly, there are certain positions of your eyes that make it easier for you to hold your attention on the ground.
It seems like that, but I'm not sure if that's actually true. There's a tendency for my eyes to direct that.
There's a common tendency for it to seem like that, and it doesn't matter whether it's really that bad or not.
Yeah.
In general, just let that happen. Even do it intentionally if it helps you. But the only thing is, sometimes people will, you know, they're following their breath, and it's like they're actually trying to look at their nose, which can be uncomfortable, strain the muscles in your eye. But you find that happening, most of the time, the position that feels right for watching the breath at the nose is as if you were looking at a point several inches in front of your nose.
Okay.
And that's a very comfortable, relaxed, that's actually a rather neutral position in terms of the muscles of the eye, very comfortable. And I know certainly for me that feels like the best place. But for someone else, it might be different. And it doesn't matter. If there's an eye position, it's not at all a strain that conduces to quality of the rest of your practice, go ahead and do it. Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
Even you may not have experienced this yet, but I find that there's certain subtleties of body position that are more conducive to certain aspects of practice than others. So, an example is that when I first started doing the pleasure jhana, I noticed that that my head would tip back and slightly to the right, and I found that very interesting. And then I found that actually by putting my head in just that position made it that much easier to enter and stay in those jhanas and to move through them. And so you might find, and I'm certainly not suggesting that that particular hip. There's anything special about that particular hip position, except for me. And my guess is there probably isn't. But for any of these practices, you might find that the certain subtleties of the way you're sitting that are more conducive. And as far as my experience goes, use those. Those are really useful if you notice them, as long as they don't create some other problem.
So if I find my body sort of naturally inclining in a particular way or wanting to shift position, not due to pain or anything like that, I should go with that? Maybe?
You should go with it, okay. Unless it's a position that's going to cause you some pain or strain later on.
Gotcha. I have one other quick question, hopefully. I find my walking meditation somewhat disturbed by concerns about certain local insects. I remember Africanized bees around here. If I see a buzzing insect rapidly orbiting me in seemingly angry fashion, should I be worried about that at all?
I personally wouldn't be worried about that at all. To decide whether a bee's behavior is angry or not is pretty difficult. It's true that the bees here are Africanized, but they also, their aggressive tendencies don't come out unless they're stimulated in some way. So there's certain kinds of loud noises, but the worst thing of all is to swat with one.
Right.
But the warning sign I would be concerned about is if there's an increasing number of bees that appear to be buzzing angular. If it's just one bee, one or two, I would think nothing of it at all. But if there's two, and then there's six, and then there's ten, I'd move out of that area.
Okay, that's very helpful. I sort of assumed it wasn't a problem, but there's a little part of my mind that was unsure, and that was nagging.
Even the original bees that they brought over from Africa to South America are docile and will land on your hand. It's only when you do something that triggers that aggressive response. And then they have a supercharged aggressive response. That's the difference.
Cool.
So if you injure one, it releases a pheromone, and all the others then will agitate.
Interesting. Good to know.
Speak to the relationship between physical stillness and mental stillness, please.
Physical
stillness and mental stillness, if there is one.
The difference between them?
The relationship between them. I find that I'm sitting very, very still. My mind is different than even very silent.
Well, they're two different things, but they tend to go together. There's a very strong relationship with them that, when there's a lot of mental stillness, there's usually a lot of physical stillness as well. Although when you start experiencing kicky movements, then that's not necessarily the case. You can have, your mind can feel very still, but you might have twitches and tremors, or your body might start rocking or something like that. Which actually, usually, though, it's not true of the sudden jerks and things like that, but those rocking movements, and, I used to always get, I could tell people he was starting to come on because my thumbs would start twitching like that. And if I just let it happen, it actually felt kind of peaceful and satisfying. Just let them do their thing. So usually the two go together. Being very still in your body is helpful for quieting your mind. And you probably notice it yourself, that when your mind is restless, it tends to be a physical restlessness, an urge to move or to twitch or anything. Calming the one helps to calm the other.
So it wouldn't be considered a cheat to make your body very, very still. I find if I can get in almost total stillness, I can advance 50% of the way to where I want to be with my mind straight away without trying almost.
So there'd be cheating to make your body very still?
Yeah, instead of relying on practicing the language you've got, to actually just be very still and then move on from there.
Actually, no, that is practicing properly. You sit down and your mind's still pretty active, but you make yourself as comfortable as you can, you know, and do whatever little adjustments that are necessary, you know, shrug your shoulders, let out the tension, and then just get totally still. Try to stay that way. That's not cheating at all. That's following the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in general, if you discover something that seems to help, go ahead and do that. Do watch in case at some point it turns out to be turning into a problem. Now, a very good example of that is mental self-talk about the quality of your meditation. And up to a certain point in your practice, that sort of inner coaching or it's very helpful, but there reaches a point where it is no longer. And so at that point you let go of it. So anything you come up with, if it seems to help, make use of it. You know, don't worry about whether it's cheating or not. If it works, it works. But be alert to the fact that there may be some other, it may help in one way, but not be helpful in another. Now, there are some things that may seem to be helpful, but they're really not, which is you find that focusing your attention on something other than the breath makes it a whole lot easier to stabilize your attention. And there can be a lot of things like that, that something comes up and it's easier to focus your attention on. In general, that's not going to be useful, because whatever it is that makes that more attractive or easier to focus your attention on initially, that's going to go away. Nothing really retains that kind of interest for very long. You know, so you're going to end up back in the same place you were with the breath. So you might as well stick with the breath when it comes to meditation objects. The most extreme example that I can think of is he is an extremely good meditator and very qualified now, but when he was first learning this method, he asked me, and I admired his openness and his willingness to ask me, but he said that sometimes he had sexual fantasies come up in his meditation. And he found it really easy to focus on him. So would that be appropriate as a meditation? He actually, I think, already knew what the answer was. But you know, in general, there are things that are easy to focus on, but there's reasons why. But anything else you find, you know, like the eye position, or spending some time deliberately making your body as still as you can, and making that, you know, spending the first few minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, of your sit, just getting the body as still and as calm as you can. That's great. That's definitely good. And of course, if you discover things that work especially well for yourself, don't hesitate to share them with other people.
Mindfulness when dreaming, when asleep, dreaming?
Yes.
So I feel like the bits that I've read and heard are like, when you realize you're lucid, when you're dreaming, you can kind of take control a little bit, like, oh, I can fly or whatever, and do stuff. And then, so my question is, and I had this thing where I was like, oh, it's my dream, but then instead of being like, so I'll decide who it's going to be when the camera gets over there, you know, because it's up to me, I just like stopped and I was like, no, just observe. Just let it do what it does and observe. And it was hard. It was like, I was just looking at the wallpaper and the camera wasn't moving. It was like, it's going to go. But I was just like, just let it do it. So I keep having this inner debate all day now, like, is that good or what? I mean, kind of like what to do with the, when it happens and you see it happening in the dream. And I'm, if like on one side, it seems like, oh, if you did whatever you wanted to or did whatever you could, it would be kind of like exercising that kind of mental facility or realizing the, I don't know, potential of your mind or something. But then part of me thinks, like, is that a good thing that it was kind of planting the seed of, like, let go and observe and just let it be? And I'm guessing you're going to say something about intention. But I just want to get it, you know, in my mind while I'm awake.
Well, when you have that experience of dreaming and knowing that you're dreaming, that you're having a lucid dream, whether you just continue to let the dream unfold while observing it from a place of knowing that you're dreaming, or whether you do something to alter it, it's still a lucid dream, I mean, in either way. Now, to be mindful in your dream, you can be mindful and not actually be a lucid dream in the sense that you don't even know that you're dreaming, but you have the same kind of mindful experience you might have in your daily life, that you notice that you are acting or behaving in a way that you don't want to or that you shouldn't. Now that's a case of you're in the dream and you're mindful, but you haven't yet realized that it hasn't become a lucid dream. The interesting thing is when you become mindful and you have a lucid dream is that if you're going to change anything about the dream, is to change your behavior. The thing that I found very interesting about lucid dreams is that very soon after you have the experience of realizing that you're dreaming while you're dreaming, that you also realize that you can alter the dream in various ways. And the most wonderful way, which unfortunately doesn't have a counterpart in waking experience, is that you can redo parts of the dream. You can go rerun it and do something different. And it's not unusual, especially in retreat, to find yourself being mindful in your dreams. And not only that, to find yourself having lucid dreams where you can actually use that mindfulness in various ways. And beyond that point, any questions of whether you should do that or shouldn't do that or something like that, as far as I know, it doesn't make any difference. Except that, as you say, in terms of the intention, there would be as much unwholesome karma in intentionally doing something in a dream that would be karmically unwholesome as there would be in your waking life.
Is it that it kind of doesn't matter? Like,
whether you do anything or not?
I was kind of having the wrong issue or something.
But, as I say, as far as I know, there's nothing right or wrong about doing anything, although the things you do could themselves be right or wrong. That's it, right?
So, can we safely say that if you're dreaming, like, if you're dreaming normally, where there's no mindfulness, there's no, it's not a lucid dream, that there are subconscious intentions which are operating outside the scope of karma causality because there's no conscious intentions going on. But as soon as you're lucid, then you begin to wander into the land of karma causality as we know in waking life.
Yes, I would agree with that. Although, as to the first part, when you're dreaming but you don't know that you're dreaming, the actions that you might be choosing in your dream mind to do, they are definitely coming out of your subconscious. And you see, when an intention becomes conscious, and I see no reason why this wouldn't be every bit as true in dream consciousness, even if you're not having a lucid dream. When an intention becomes conscious and it is acted upon, then it is reinforcing that intention in the future. It's like any other habit.
Since we're on the dream thing, this is like a esoteric. But sometimes there's dreams where, well, the dreams are bizarre, but there's some dreams that don't seem the result of your subconscious in particular. It's a life that's so different and so other, but realistic.
Yeah.
That you could speculate that you were potentially within the mind of another or someone else's mind. I've heard you speak about this. So if that's indeed the case, like, then how can you hold somebody responsible if you're experiencing something that's so totally other? You know what I'm saying?
Yes. And first of all, it's not a matter of holding responsible. It's really a matter of whether the intentions that arose and were acted upon would be reinforced as a result of that. You know, it would seem to me that if you are having a dream that, properly speaking, belongs to a different mind than your own, that the intentions in that dream are not yours either. But I don't think they're going to. That would still live?
Yeah. Yeah. Try turning it off and turning it back on. Sorry.
Actually, we can pass the one around. So, I'm starting to think, you know, I switched the batteries. I'm starting to think it's this battery that's about finally. Trial and error, doing all the stupid things that didn't work. I switched the battery and see if that worked. Anyway, yes. And I find the type of dreams that you mentioned, everybody has them. Did anybody here ever have that kind of really amazing dream? Or, you know, what I find interesting about these kinds of dreams is you may not normally be aware of the amount of backstory that's present in all of your conscious experience, but it is always there. And when you're having one of those dreams, the dream has a backstory that's completely different than your usual backstory, which
when it happens, makes you aware that the other dreams where, you know, the ones that do feel like you, that's because they have your backstory. Even though the circumstances might not correspond to anything, you know, you may be in a situation that you've never been in before, there's still that sense of who you are. But you have these other dreams where it becomes complete with a, I think the detail, the history, everything is just, what I find most fascinating about that is it just is, to me, it's saying that in sleep, the barriers by which a mind segregates itself from mind in the larger sense, that those barriers can be very easily breached. But I don't think there's any more karmic consequence to experiencing those things in the dream as there is, say, watching a movie. Although there can be karmic consequences to the emotions and intentions and inclinations, you know, that arise when you're watching a movie. Which is why it's important to be mindful when you watch movies. You should try to be mindful when you're having somebody else's dreams too.
Pass that back.
To make it past forgetting and gross distractions, I feel like I put a lot of attention into being able to detect these distractions, especially the thoughts, before they become forgetting. And I'm wondering, if you're practicing at stage six, then it's all of that intention to be very aware of thoughts, for example, in the peripheral awareness, but not just letting them be, but actually trying to be aware of them in the peripheral. Is that going to now be counterproductive to developing exclusive focus?
Yeah.
Just to clarify, it's all about how you're using attention and awareness. And so, in the process of overcoming forgetting and gross distraction, you were using attention in order to develop a strong introspective awareness so that you could recognize distractions, subtle distractions before they became gross distractions, and gross distractions before they became forgetting. But where the process leads to is the place where you no longer need to use attention for that. That peripheral awareness alerts you, so that if you were to examine what happens, you become aware of a subtle distraction that is becoming stronger and is likely to become a gross distraction. But without ever directing attention to it at all, you do just the opposite. You tighten up your attention. In response to that awareness, you tighten up your attention. So you're getting to the point where there is no movement of attention involved at all in preventing a gross distraction from developing. Furthermore, as you continue practicing this, as you find happening in stage five, is that more and more often there's not even that much of a conscious intention to tighten up the focus when the distraction is present. It just kind of happens automatically, so that there's very little doing at all. Just peripheral awareness detects, and then the correction happens, and you may know that it happened, but there's less doing at all. So by the time you get to stage six, what you're doing is you're recognizing that so long as a thought is a subtle distraction, that there is an alternation of attention to it. It's not the strong movement of attention like you had when you were training yourself to detect subtle distractions that were a threat. But there's much, much more rapid and subtle movement that the alternation that makes it stand out as a subtle distraction. So you're trying to overcome that. And so there is no movement of attention, even less movement of attention than there was when you were automatically correcting for subtle distraction. When you're automatically correcting for them, there was still attention alternating with them. And now you're just trying to reduce that alternating attention to the point where the thoughts come and go in the background, but they never achieve the status of a subtle distraction. And at that point, there are fewer thoughts, there's fewer thoughts. Certainly, you're much less aware of thoughts. So you see how it's a continuation. There's really no contradiction at all. It's an extension of the same thing we've been doing all along.
It feels like if you... I'm just going to talk loudly. Tell me if this doesn't work. It feels like I've been kind of... I've stopped intentionally checking in so much, but I instead just have an attention to be aware of thoughts in the periphery. And so there is some automatic correction going on.
Okay.
But I have to maintain, if I don't maintain an intention to keep being aware in the periphery, then the peripheral, then it won't keep going on itself. It won't self-sustain. So if it feels like it clicks into when it might be appropriate to be at stage six, though, I'm wondering if still having that intention to be aware in the periphery is going to put too much energy into the periphery and kind of keep it from being able to be more exclusive focused. Is that the same thing you already answered?
No. That's very interesting. See, the thing is that you're going to have to hold that intention to be peripherally aware, and if the correction doesn't happen automatically, to make the correction, that intention is going to have to be there until stage eight, until effortlessness. So you have, in stage five, it requires a lot of vigilance and a fair bit of the need to consciously initiate the correction is going to be decreasing, but it's going to be still there in stage five. In stage six, the need to consciously initiate the correction is going to be less, but it's still going to be there sometime. But all the way through seven, you're going to have that vigilance. And if you don't, you're going to find yourself slipping right back into subtle distractions or even gross distractions.
So you just hold the intention then to be peripherally aware but not to actually look at the, you don't want to look at the thoughts, because then you're, then they're a distraction.
Well, the thing is that the tendency to look at the thought with attention decreases by itself as it becomes more and more evident in peripheral awareness. So, it sort of takes care of itself. But yeah, you do still have, you have to have that intention to be peripherally aware of it. And you have to learn to know whether you're knowing of a threatening distraction is due to attention and peripheral awareness. But by the time you get to stage six, a big part of knowing that you have subtle distractions is that they are subtle distractions and they are good. So in stage six, you're working on eliminating that type.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hopefully that. It's good to talk it through, because there's a lot of subtleties to it.
Very different to set the intention to not do it. And really tricky, because it's counterintuitive. Like, to set the intention to surrender or let go into a particular process feels very different. And I find it's like, setting the intention, okay, let go, and then waiting, and then nothing happens, or the thing doesn't happen, and then, like, how do you know when to set it again, or what, it just feels really different to me, and I'm curious if you have any advice on when the time comes to set the intention to not do, or to allow something, how that's different. Because many times when that's happened and there's been some kind of insight, it seems like it just happens. And then you think, okay, well, this will happen again. And then, but then there's this anticipation or something that seems to get in the way. Does that make sense?
I think so.
And maybe a really good example for what you're asking about. How do you intend not to have extra patience? Realistically, the nature of that is the intention not to have expectations has to be set in advance, but the holding of it's kind of subliminal, and it tends to fade. So it's like to remind yourself, even though you haven't had to act on that intention, you need to remind yourself, you're here and refresh that intention. But the intention remains latent until the expectations present themselves. recognize the body. The things that you need to practice a kind of letting go, you really rely on other signs that indicate that they're happening, so that you can let go of them earlier on. So if you feel yourself starting to manifest as indicators that you're starting to do the thing that you had set your intention not to do, then that latent attention comes to the fore. And usually, you know, it's not really an intention to stop doing something, as more an intention to do something different. And you used the word surrender, and so that would be a thing that would apply even to expectations, that if you want not to get caught up in your expectations, so it's not that you're going to intend for the expectations that go away. Instead, the letting go of the expectation is really more of a surrendering to what's happening, allowing things to be the way they are, rather than building up this energy charge that things should somehow be different. So maybe the best way to frame the answer to that question is identify the positive alternative that corresponds to the negative intention. Okay? Like not getting caught by a distraction. The positive alternative to that is focusing more closely on the meditation object. And so the same thing would be true of the more refined forms of letting go. But in terms of the intention has to be set and then has to be renewed periodically, because it's going to decay for a time.
Yeah. Thank you, that's helpful. I find that it works for a while and then after a while, when it's time to renew, that's been a little bit of striving kind of stuff. And it can be extremely seldom, but it's just enough to counteract the intention. So, thank you. Yeah.
I think you're probably all coming to recognize the feelings that come up when you're striving, right? Become sensitive to those. So there's a certain kind of striving that is good. I tried to find words to describe that kind of striving, and I've chosen the word diligence. It's that determination. You know exactly what you need to do and not do. And so you're very diligent about doing those things. And that's different than that striving of trying to make something happen. And I think the entire process, every step along the way, can be framed in terms of simple tasks. At every stage, the tasks that you're performing are very simple. And so you bring to that with diligence in performing those tasks and not trying to do anything other than that. We're trusting that by performing the task, the results will come. And thereby, it gives you a way to strive productively without slipping into an unproductive mode of stressing yourself, getting tired out, trying to make something happen that you can't make happen, and so forth.
If anybody has any more practice questions, if not, I had a question that's like a follow-up to what you were talking about yesterday.
Sure.
When you were talking about stream entry, and so it's my understanding that you still have craving, right, when you have achieved that, and that your life is so drastically better, you know. And I guess I was just thinking about, and craving is what makes life hard, right? Pretty much, I mean, that's it. Like, craving is what makes life difficult.
Yeah.
So it must be somehow that your relationship to crave, you're still there. It's still there. So it, but it must change somehow.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could talk about what that's like what,
sure.
How it changes and what the experience of it is after you cross that push.
Yes, that's a very good question. Yes, you still do have craving, and you still do have the suffering that craving brings. But there's a big change in the degree of it, and your ability to recognize it. It doesn't have the same hold over you that it once did, but it's definitely still there. One of the things that I as a stream enterer you'll become particularly aware of, and this is a point in the first path where you're starting to approach second path. You start to become aware that the craving itself has a particular kind of pleasure associated with it. Even though craving causes suffering, the state of craving has a certain pleasure associated with it. And it's a rather addictive thing. You've got this lifelong addiction to craving. I think you could probably think of examples of this. And it's not that you can't notice this before you become a stream enterer, but at some point you realize that you have a craving for the state of craving, but this craving itself has a certain pleasure associated with it. Even paradoxically, there is a certain attachment to your own suffering, because your suffering strengthens your sense of self, of being real. And this, in the practice as a stream enterer, you begin to become more aware of these subtleties of craving. Craving isn't as strong, and it's much easier to circumvent it. You don't become so easily and so quickly and so constantly overwhelmed by it as you did before. And it's in fact weaker. But it's still a very significant part of your life. And you begin to realize that there are only those periods, and there are periods where there is no craving. It's only those periods, those mental states, it's only when you're in the mental state where there is no craving at all that is a truly satisfactory mental state. And at those other ones, even the ones where there's pleasure, if that pleasure is mixed with a very potent dissatisfactoriness that's there. And this further insight into craving and suffering is what brings you to the second path. So things are a whole lot better. But you know, that's the way it is with a new normal. You don't have as much craving, you don't have as much suffering. But once that becomes your new normal for a while, then you get to the place where this may be less than it was before, but it's totally unacceptable. And then you start having the increasing motivation to do something about it. Is there more about that that you'd like to ask? Is there more deeply into it?
I was wondering if it was kind of like, if this relates at all, if it had anything to do with like, the craving will come up but you know it's not true or something like that? Like, is that part of what makes it weaker?
Yes, absolutely. What makes it weaker is that you know that it's craving. That's part of what makes it weaker. You're much more. The thing is that you, as a stream entering, you're going to have a much greater level of sustained mindfulness all of the time. That is one of the benefits of first path, is that you just become a much more mindful person. And so you're much more aware as you go through your life of the role that craving is playing. And so you never forget, you begin to recognize, and in fact just the opposite, you begin to recognize more and more of the role that craving is playing, and including having the feeling at times that everything I say and do is a result of craving. But of course it's not. And so experiences that are not, that really begin to stand out, shine. Okay, that's where I want to be all the time. That's where your motivation is going to be. And that's going to continue. The craving becomes subtler. And second path, the craving is much weaker, and you're actually seeking out craving in order to overcome it. But the third path, the non-return, there's still a kind of craving. It's no longer a craving for things of the world. It's not a craving for material pleasures, sense pleasures, or any of these other kinds of things.
Yes, it's battery problem.
And it's not the craving that comes from, you know, aversion to physical pain and things like that. But there is still this strong craving for being, for existence, for, you know, the craving that is associated with this underlying sense of being a separate self, and one can hold to that. So, right up to the coming in Arhat, there is some form of craving. But it gets better and better all the way along. And all the way along you're having an experience of what moves you to the next stage is getting to the point where the level of suffering that you're experiencing is no longer tolerable. On first half, those periods with no craving at all are pretty infrequent. They're just frequent enough that eventually, you know, you have this really solid, you know, like, enough of this. That's where I want to be all. Second and third path, the periods with no noticeable craving become much, much become more common and more extended. But it's that it still comes back. And eventually, the end, the theoretical end of the path, when you become an arhat, where there's no craving at any time, no attachment to self, at any time, ever, 24 hours a day, whatever, the rest of your life. That's the theoretical end of the path. That's the end of the path defined in terms of craving and suffering. I don't think it's the end of the path in terms of spiritual evolution.
When you were talking about craving, I was thinking about an experience of really wanting something. And I felt all the agitation in my body, like, oh, I better have to get this because it's going to be gone, you know? And then there was this realization of what it was doing in the body, and there was this feeling like, whoa, that's like greed, you know, that's happening. And then it was still there, but it was different. It just kind of rose. It didn't have that excitation of the body that the first one did, you know, like, oh, I gotta do something, you know. It just sort of rose and then it passed. And so I was just curious for you to talk to that.
Yeah. So, what I'm hearing you describing is the fact that craving comes in many different degrees, and that's really true. And most of the time, the people hear somebody talk about craving, what they associate that is a really strong point. But the more experience that they have, the more understanding they develop, then they hear somebody talk about craving and they realize the pervasiveness of those milder forms. And the cravings that I was talking about a few minutes ago that a person's dealing with on first path, comparatively speaking, they're much, you know, it's, you don't have that aching greed anymore. Manifests and, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. But there's definitely greed still there. It's more the milder forms of it. And as I say, as you approach second path, you become more aware of the subtlest forms of craving. You become dissatisfied with a degree of craving that before stream entry you probably didn't even know existed. You were acquainted with the infrequent craving. Where you see it in totally different way. Does it feel like we're done? We had a good discussion. So, do something amazing and different something. Thank you very much. Enjoy the discussion. Oh, tomorrow.